Welcome to the Gary T. Roller Show. Join Gary as he chats with today's innovators and changemakers of the health and wellness movement. Together, we will discover our healthier selves.
What is up, family? Family, friends, how are you doing? What is new in your world? What is interesting? What is amazing? I want to hear from you all the time. Feedback is key, and at the end of the day, community is everything, which spreads into communication, which spreads into hugs and love and just going far together, like I always love reiterating in every show. So this week, I have a super exciting guest. He sounds like a movie actor. He's not a movie actor. He's doing way better things than movie actors. His name is Gerald Jones. He's a guy that was engulfed in a privileged school system and raised in a gang-ridden, tough neighborhood, but he overcame. We chat about how Gerald overcame the racism and segregation to excel in the military and then as a coach and leading example of a businessman. We go in very deep on how people have a bias towards their own people in inverted commas, and this is essentially one of the major flaws Gerald saw being on tour to Iraq. He is now a coach, not just a businessman, he's also a coach to a lot of people in the military, and he's trying to allow people to ask the right questions, key, and see through the veil of mediocrity and expand their thinking to what really drives them and what is really essentially their purpose. Gerald is a voice of reason, and he's also a voice to so many people out there. He's got a podcast where he allows the man and woman next door to share their business ideas and their voice. And one of his biggest missions today in his world, if he summed it up, is to build wealth and political power as well as leadership within the black community. Because as much as we are very sensitive to talk about the segregation in America or all around the world between black, white, whatever color your skin is, it's apparent wherever you go. And there has been heaps of oppression, no matter what country you're in. I'm in South Africa, born and raised here in the country that is known for apartheid, but also known for the hero of Nelson Mandela. The same racism, segregation is happening in the United States of America. He is fighting the cause. Fighting in the cause with a voice of reason and a voice of love and allowing people a stage through free platforms like podcasting, his websites, coaching them one-on-one, allowing them to see the light. Because at the end of the day, all humans, no matter what LSM you're from, whatever skin color you're from, whatever faith you follow, we all have the same desires in us. And that's a desire of love and happiness. Guys, we all just want to be happy. And why not just go on that journey and do it together? Because by doing it together, we will definitely find that happiness. So enjoy that episode. This one's going to move you. It's incredible. Share it with your family and friends. Let's get the whole world moving. Guys, welcome back to another episode of the Gary Tirola Show. I have got a very special guest this week, Gerald Jones. It sounds like an actor. He hails from Nebraska. And I am very fortunate to be able to sit down with him and talk to him over the interwebs. Technology does make life so much easier. Gerald, thank you so much for joining us.
Indeed, Gary, thank you for having me on. Really excited.
Of course. So, Gerald, first up, in your bio everywhere, you have a story as a military veteran. You turned consultant, turned entrepreneur with a mission to build wealth and political power within the black community. So I'm going to I really want to explore this. I come from South Africa, which is, as we all know, we experienced apartheid that ended in 94, thankfully to Nelson Mandela, a hero globally. But before I get into your mission, I want to understand your story, the Gerald story. You landed up in the military. What was Gerald's life like before that, before you landed up in the military?
Oh, certainly. So I guess we'll go all the way back. So I live in Nebraska now, but I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, and I was an only child of two parents who worked really hard. My dad managed fast food restaurants my entire life. My mom was, she ended up being a project manager, but she just kind of did, you know, kind of office business project type work. I didn't know exactly what she did growing up. But I was the only one, and we lived in what you would consider to be kind of a rougher part of the city. In fact, for anybody who would remember from the early 90s, there was an HBO special called Gangs Banging in Little Rock. And one of the gangs was literally right around the corner from where I was as a kid. So, you know, that was kind of where I started from. But because I was an only child and because my parents kind of decided we're going to make sure that he can go and do whatever he wants, they worked really hard and sacrificed a lot to put me into a private school. So basically, as a kid, I was going to school across town, and I was the only Black kid who was in my grade at that school. And then I would go to church, and I was like one of the few or only kids in the church who was in private school. And so just growing up, I grew up in this kind of two worlds where I didn't fit in either one, because I definitely wasn't one of these privileged rich kids that I was going to school with every day, and they let me know it. And then I definitely didn't speak the same lingo and have the same experiences as a lot of the kids who I was going to church with. And so I just didn't fit.
But and who I did were grow you up, relating oh. to more at that stage? I mean, it's quite a segregated world that you were in. You must have been so torn between two ideals, almost. Not even ideals, like imbalanced lifestyles.
Yeah, but see, that's the weird thing is neither one. I really didn't relate well to either, because I also am I'm very introverted. I'm a huge reader. I'm kind of a nerdy guy, and so even at school, I had only very few friends, even if it was just because I wasn't one of the popular kids, right? So I think I grew up more relating to kind of that privileged side, because that was who I spent 8 hours a day with, as opposed to, you know, Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings with.
Yeah.
So that kind of became what I'm more associated with. But then I finally, at high school, I asked my parents to let me get out of that environment, went to a public school, finished up there. And then immediately, when I graduated high school, June 1st of 2000, June 19th, I was in Marine Corps boot camp. So by the time high school was over, I was just done with all of it. I was tired of kids. I was tired of learning. I was bored. And so I just said, I've got to do something else.
Why did you ask your parents to leave private school and go to public school? What was behind that decision making?
You know, my parents put me into that particular school so I would learn how to fight here, which we're a podcast. You're the only one who can see this with my head. my parents, I found later talking to my mom, they put me in that specific school so I could learn how to deal with racism in a way that was genius, is the way that I would put it. Because when you're completely surrounded by people who see themselves as good people and who aren't just overtly coming at you with racist slurs and this, that, and the other, and yet everything that they do just is to remind you, you don't fit, you're not one of us, we don't want you here. You have to learn how to deal with that in a way that doesn't succumb to what a lot of them want. I had a lot of kids who wanted to see me fight because I would get kicked out of the school. I had a lot of the administrators in the school who wanted to see me fight so that they could get me kicked out of the school so that they could have what they wanted, which was this pure, you know, we all belong here type situation.
Yeah, of course.
And year after year, I dealt with that. And I started out fighting with my hands. And by the time I was seventh, eighth grade, I had the sharpest tongue in the world. I could run miles around people with wit. And eventually they would be so pissed off, but they didn't know why. And I would win, but I would avoid the physical altercation. And it takes a lot of work to do that. It's draining doing that every single day. So by the time that I'd gone through the ninth grade, I was done. I don't want to do this anymore. And I just wanted to be able to go to school. And so I asked if I could go to the school that my mom had graduated from, which I ended up doing. And it was just a completely different experience. And it was a whole new learning experience because now I was in a school that was 60% black and down in the middle of the city. So it's just a whole new world.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
Okay. So we're at a stage now where you transition back into public school. You are now on the flip side, a complete different emotional education, social education, being an introvert at heart. You've now forced your way into really the society that your parents grew up in. And you start learning the ropes from there. You must be holding on to some animosity, some anger towards the community for not accepting you, whether it was the rich white community or it was the black community. How did you deal with these emotions?
Man, you're good. So at least at that time, I didn't really know if I was angry. I think when I first got into the public school, like my first semester there, I had almost a 4-point GPA. The second semester, I discovered that girls thought I was cute and I had a 1.5. Nice. So that was my first adjustment was having a social life and then realizing I don't care as much about school as I thought I did now that girls notice me.
Yeah.
And then having to find that balance and bring that GPA back up. That was the first adjustment. But then the second adjustment was really in finding my place in that society, if you will. The school I graduated from, it's actually a historic school. It's Little Rock Central High School. It's the first high school that was integrated in the South in the 1950s. They had a whole movie about Ernest Green, who was the first person who graduated from there. So I went to a school
story.
That had a racial history it anyway. But yeah, just figuring out where I fit into that. And then once I kind of found my place, the great thing was the school was so big that there were enough people that even the folks who didn't have a group, we had a group. So it wasn't in high school. It really wasn't that big a deal because I found the people who I fit with. Yeah. And there were enough of us that everybody just kind of had their own cliques and we would all there. I didn't have that traditional high school experience of there's the bullies and the cool kids and the jocks and the nerds. It really was, hey, there's enough of us here that everybody's got their own crew. We're just going to do our own thing. So it was, I had a great high school experience, but coming from a really rigorous academic experience, I got to that high school and I was just like, I'm bored. And so I just kind of coasted through and I was ready for it to be done because I didn't learn anything new and I didn't want to learn anything new. I just wanted to get out. I just wanted to be done so I could go adult.
Okay. So now you've done high school, you've done the primary school, you've done high school, and now you're at a point where being an academic, I find it a very strange choice to enroll straight away into military. What was your reasoning behind this? And I'd like to understand also, you can carry on explaining, how was the military landscape for you finding your feet?
Yeah. So I've got, you're going to find there's a lot of non-traditional going on here. So in my military experience started out in the reserves because, I had a full scholarship offered to me to go to the state university. Just based on academics, my ACT score was really high. And so I had a full ride with room and board. All I had to do was keep a 3.0 GPA, no sports, no nothing. And I was like, great, easy, college. And so I accepted that scholarship in at the end of my junior year. So my entire senior year, I had nothing really to look forward to. I knew what I was doing when I graduated. So I quit the basketball team. I quit all these things. I just kind of floated through my senior year. And I ran into a recruiter near the end of that year who just asked me what I was going to do. And I said, I'm going to college on a full scholarship. He didn't believe me. He said, well, just come to my office, talk to me anyway. So I went to his office. I took this ASVAB test. I got like a 96 out of it. And then he was like, holy crap, you're smart. You should be an officer. I said, no, I'm going to school, full scholarship. Well, he said, well, you could at least join the reserves. And then you could be a Marine. You wear the really cool uniform. You can prove how, you know, what you've got. And I was like, you know, that could work. So I already knew I was going to college full scholarship. I said, I might as well join the Marines and see if I can do this. Because, you know, the U.S. Marines were supposed to be the toughest military branch in the States. So I just wanted to see if I could do it. I was bored.
Yeah.
And challenged I said, you. Challenge.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I joined. I went through boot camp. Breezed through that.
Boot camp. Let's just take a pause here. Like from I don't know if it's like the Hollywood movies that I've watched, but boot camp has never seemed like something that someone breezes through.
Well, I had a tough dad and I had a really tough high school basketball coach.
Okay, cool.
So by the time I got to Marine boot camp and I was being yelled at by these three or four drill instructors at any given time, I was like, yeah, been through this before. So let me just pick out of all these yelling words what they want me to do and I'll just do it.
Okay,
and
cool.
It became simple. So yeah, I mean, it wasn't like I physically breezed through it. It was a lot of work, but the mental part of boot camp is what they want to weed people out based on whether or not they can handle the pressure of combat.
Sure.
There's a lot of really physically capable people who would crack. And so that's really the part. And that part wasn't hard at all. The physical part, they get you there. But yeah, so boot camp, infantry school, I come back and I just delayed my scholarship for a semester. And I started college in the spring semester of 2001, as opposed to the fall semester of 2000, if I hadn't gone to the Marines. So I didn't so much skip education as say, education's locked up. Let me do something else at the same time.
Okay, cool.
Okay. And it just so happened that spring 2001, I'm starting school. I'm in the Marines. I'm thinking I'm just going to go play in the woods and drink and fire guns once a month. And then fall 2001, 9/11 happens and suddenly it's real. Suddenly you're not just going to be a reservist. And the next 20 years of my life has been real.
Yeah. Yeah. Like shit's just got real. So yeah. 9/11 happened. We all know what happened that day. Were you enlisted straight away? What was the process for you when you saw it happen? First, I want to get your emotions behind this. When you saw it happen, how did reality sink in for you? Because you must have realized on that spot, shit's going to get real.
Yeah, it did. I had a girlfriend. I stayed at her apartment. Skipped my first class, just slept in. And then I was like, all right, I'll go back to my dorm. I'll take a shower and then I'll get ready for my 11 o'clock class. And I go back to my dorm and all these people are in the lobby around this TV and they're watching a movie. I'm like, never seen that movie before.
Yeah.
Strange. It's like, what movie has a burning building? And they're like, oh no, this just happened. Like a plane accidentally ran into the World Trade Center. And I was like, oh, okay, well, God, that's dumb. And I just went back to my room and before that, as I was driving back to my dorm, I saw that gas was like $5 or $6 a gallon. And I didn't know why. It was like suddenly it was immediate price gouge of that. But anyway, that has nothing to do with this. But so there was all these little tips that I was living in this post-apocalyptic world, but I wasn't paying attention. I was like that guy in the horror movie. And then I walked back out. And I walked out in time to see the second plane actually fly into that building.
Yeah.
And that was when I was like, shit just got real. And I immediately called my unit. You know, I was in college 2.5 hours away from where my unit was. And I called my unit. I called my first sergeant and I said, first sergeant, what's going on? Where are we going? That was the first things that came out of my mouth. He was like, slow down, Jones. We don't know anything yet, but keep your phone next to you. There's a lot that has to happen before they just rip us up and take us somewhere. And so I immediately just knew stuff was about to happen. I didn't know what. I was a young, you know, 18, 19 year old kid who just found out the world is about to go on fire and you're going to be a part of it. So it was actually a couple of years before we went anywhere. But we immediately, our posture changed, the type of work we were doing changed, the type of training we started doing changed. And my first deployment wasn't until Iraq in 2003 when that invasion happened.
Okay. So two years of prep, your focus must have changed completely. Now, here's the big question. Mm-hmm. For a man, which we're going to get to later for listeners right now, with a man fighting so much for minority gains, minority balancing out, especially within the Black community, how did you find yourself placed now in the military home, now going into another country and almost by force, should I say, and this is with fear of upsetting some people that are listening, being part of the military by force, but also because by invasion, you have to go in with the military. Did you ever think twice of, should I be doing this? Is this the right thing? Like, are we being told the right things, etc.?
So that didn't come until over a decade later. You know, at that time, you asked me earlier, which one of these worlds did I identify with most? By the time I graduated high school, I really identified more with the kind of white American version of the story of things. I joined the Marines, and because it was a reserve unit, we were all from the same place. So I was surrounded by literally a bunch of white guys from all over the rural parts of Arkansas who were very racist. They were very what you consider conservative. And that's literally who I spent all of my time with as a Marine. Hmm. And my viewpoints were very much skewed by that. I had absolutely no problem going into Iraq. Yeah. And before I went, I had all of the same prejudices, the same bigotry in my head, the same xenophobic crap of the negative ideas that we have about other people's cultures. Yeah. And the thing about going to Iraq, I went there, and when I came home with a huge appreciation for Iraqi culture and a huge disappointment for U.S. culture. That was the big thing I got out of that.
Wow, that's so beautiful, man. That gives me goosebumps just like listening to that. What is the reason for that? Is it because of their culture being so close to each other, so integrated compared to American culture?
It was much more they know who they are.
Yeah.
You know, we think as Americans, we've been here for 250 years or whatever the heck, and we're so proud of our Constitution and our this, that, and the other, and our history and all this crap. I'm sorry, cradle of civilization. The people who live in what is now Iraq, they know who they are, and they can actually take that all the way back thousands of years.
Yeah.
And the pride of knowing who they are, who they represent every single day in their lives, the family ties, the tribal ties, it's a different feeling when you interact with somebody who truly knows who they are. Little things like, you know, going into someone's home to engage with them and being offered food, even if you're a big weapon wielding invader who's coming in to talk to someone about very unhappy things, you're offered food, you're offered drink. You walk into a home of someone who you know does not have nearly as much of the privilege that we have in the United States. And yet the Quran is right next to the door. Everything in the house is spotless all of the time. And there's this you could tell a respect for themselves that rolls into a respect for everybody else around. And it's just seeing that time and time and time again, and then coming back home and being surrounded by people who are oblivious to everyone except themselves and no idea who we really are, but thinking that we're the greatest in the world, it bothered me.
Yeah.
It really was an eye-opening experience.
It's almost what's apparent to me is a lack of judgment. Say we're talking about Iraq now, a lack of judgment on the Iraqi side from an individual point of view. People are willing to accept other people before they make a conclusion on that exact person based on their culture, color of their skin, faith, etc. How long did it take you now to get to this reserves thinking, this high school reserves thinking of Arkansas, to the moment where you eventually leave the military on your own accord?
Well, so I actually spent 8 years in the Marine Corps. After we came back, I spent quite a bit of time leading Marines and actually preparing for the second trip back to Iraq, which happened 4 years later.
Yeah.
But I took that opportunity to groom better leaders, to groom more empathetic leaders. And I spent my time actually making better Marines who were more prepared to engage with people from other cultures in an empathetic way. 'Cause war sucks. And there are truly bad people who you have to go kill in war sometimes. But just because someone lives in another nation does not make them automatically one of the bad people.
Sure.
This is their home. We're coming to help them with bad people. Being much more discerning about that, being more empathetic, makes you a stronger warrior. And so I spent the rest of my time trying to develop better leaders, better warriors. And then I left that branch of service and I went to the Air Force, and I've been there for the last 10 years. And I've spent quite a bit of my time in the Air Force teaching. I taught Iraqi culture. I taught Afghan culture, and I taught Islam to members of the military for the last decade or so, mainly for that same reason. The more that we understand the people who we are going to help, the more that easy it is to discern citizens from bad people and to make sure that we're engaging with citizens as respectfully as we possibly can in their homes, in their home countries, so that we can actually help them rather than just being the big bad bullies who go around the world and blow stuff up. So I've actually been... That's one of the other things that I've spent the rest of my adult life doing so far, is helping our military be more prepared to do their job in a way that honors who we're supposed to be and honors the nations that we're going to help.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And it's a beautiful sentiment, because a lot of people that have a change in belief walk away from whatever they're doing at that time and do such life-altering things, and it takes a lot of patience and a lot of resilience to stay within that culture and try to change the culture, not change your own landscape. So I admire you there. It's very admirable. A controversial question now. What, if any, get me to understand. I'm not the stereotypical political follower per se, but what rights does, say, America, I'm using our example now because we're talking about it, what right does America have in entering another country, in fighting the bad people that you say, and kind of creating a place of unease for everyone else that's not the bad people, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it's not like Iraq is not America's country. Yes, they did bomb the towers. We are, I don't know how many years later, 18 years later.
Well, it wasn't even Iraq, you know, it wasn't even Iraq who bombed the towers. It wasn't Afghans who bombed the towers, right? It was, I get your question. I think the only true way I can answer that question is that, there are people leading nations who are brokering deals with each other, who are asking for help, who are offering things in exchange for help, there's so much diplomacy that happens between and amongst nations, just constantly brokering help, deals, and support. And some countries do it for their own purposes that are behind the scenes, and some country, but when it all comes down to it, the few men and women who are at the heads of these countries, who are trying to do the best for their nations, a lot of times broker things that are in their best interest and some that are not. And when it all comes down to it, when those decisions are made and when those people make those deals, what ends up happening is you have literally millions of people on both or all sides who are left to just do and deal with it.
Accept the decisions.
Right. Whether it be the Iraqi people or the Iraqi army or the Iranian army or the Jordanian army or the Australian army or the US army, whoever it is, there are just so many millions of humans around the world who pick up and go somewhere on the decisions of just a few folks who are brokering things in whatever interests. And I can't tell you that the U.S. has the right to go anywhere to do anything in someone else's nation. And if it's done by any country without working with the leadership of that country saying help, I think it's wrong. And it's not just for the U.S., it's everywhere. But I'm not privy to all of the diplomacy that happens to all I know is that it just sucks. When whatever comes out and wherever we or anybody else goes, it just sucks. And down at the individual level, every day, you've got to be the best prepared to go into that sucky situation and make the best decisions you can. And I don't think that we as humans can do that when we are living in our own bubbles of a bias towards other people. I think that that is probably one of the most dangerous things that we have, is sending people around the world who know nothing of anything except their own home and their own biases, and then saying, go to this country and help.
Well, this is a this is such a beautiful way to segue into the biases of America per se. And this now gets into your mission where pretty much all online, if people follow you, no matter where they see you, your podcast, your mission is really to build wealth and political power in the black community. Now, segregation is happening in every country. I think in some countries it's worse than it was, because we are using these justifications that are just blatantly misleading, should I say. What is happening in America? What is happening in your own home soil between all different skin colors?
Yeah. The biggest thing that I see here is there has always been, and until we make it change, there will always be a situation where everyone who is not a Native American or a Black American, and I don't say African American because there are African immigrants in America and I would consider them African American, but a Black American descended from the people who were slaves. Everybody in this nation who is not of one of those groups does not see just how horribly this nation has treated and continues to treat us in those two groups.
Yeah.
Native Americans first and then Black Americans. And for centuries, the propaganda mixed with the policies, mixed with just the generational biases and beliefs, has gotten us to a point now where if you are not Native American or Black American, you don't see at all the racism that is just heaped upon us every single day in every action and in every event. And if you are one of those two groups, you can't escape it. It is there. However much money you have or make, wherever you happen to live, racism is this cloud, this veiled cloud in the United States now that is so insidious because it's not overt anymore. To me, overt racism, I grew up in the South where overt racism was really very much still a thing. And you talk to a lot of people in the South, especially Black people, and they say, I'd rather live here because at least here I know who the racists are. They'll tell me and I can just stay away from them.
Yeah.
But everywhere else, they're there and they do it with a smile. And you're constantly wondering what was behind that thing they said, or what was the reason why I was passed over for this thing. And you know it's got something to do with it, but it's not overt and you can't say anything about it, which just drives you crazy. It just drives you crazy. And it's constantly there, but the people who aren't targeted by it just don't see it.
Well, it makes the landscape very hard. And I can relate to this animosity, this lack of overtness in South Africa as well, and a lot of other countries. Any country I go to, whether it's in the Middle East with Filipinos, whether it's here with between black and white people, and in America, I've seen it. My sister lives in California. I come here. California declares that they're so democratic and that, and also Ura and all that. But you still go there and you see the same thing happening there. Luckily, thankfully, because of social media, we are seeing a lot more people outspoken and trying to treat the cause and trying to turn things around. But I find we stuck in a landscape of a lot of anger, hate, and a lot of fighting, a lot of people taking it into the trenches. And I'm not too sure if this is going to solve anything as well. Like, in my opinion, a lot of physical fighting, a lot of hate speech causes egos to grow and us to react. And as a coach, you coach a lot of people for coaching people of imbalances on Iranian lifestyle and Afghan lifestyle, etc., in the military and the Air Force. What techniques can you bring into communities in America that will help us?
Yeah, I very much focus on self responsibility and accountability and education. That to me is the thing that is going to get us to the next level when it comes to this. Mainly because you can't educate people. And when I say people, I mean literally masses of people. They're going to do whatever dumb animalistic thing it is that they're manipulated to do. For example, we have a president right now. That's all I'll say. We do. We have a certain person. How he got there goes to what I just said.
Yeah.
People on whole are together. You are not going to influence them through anything except emotional, fear-based communication. But the individual person is who you have to connect with, and it takes work to get that person beyond that bubble. And it's almost a one-to-one-to-one-to-one thing where you just have to get people to break through and see what's on the other side of this veil. One of the really interesting things that I found is that, you know, there are a lot of white Americans here who are just as dedicated as I am to ending this racism thing. And they see it just as clearly as I do. And what I found is like 99% of those people, when you end up having a conversation with them, you find out I spent a year in the Peace Corps. I did a mission trip in Africa. I did a this, I did a that, but they've spent time out of the United States and they've seen what unbridled racism looks like when it's overt. And I call that cracking the code, because once you've seen what it looks like overtly, then you come back to the United States and the veil is there, but it's broken because you know what the code words are. And so you see beyond what they're trying to cover up and you're like, this is messed up.
Yeah.
This has to be fixed. And you're standing next to somebody who's like, well, what are you talking about? But once you've seen beyond the veil, you can't go back. So to me, it's getting people to crack through where they actually see what's behind this veil. And whether that's through traveling elsewhere, whether that's through education, whether it's through immersion, whatever it is, you have to get individual people to see beyond the veil. And that's a really hard thing to do.
I think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was so formidable and so proactive in his time of leading the masses, leading the world, really getting the attention of the world. And one of the big reasons I've always seen with him is because he had a why, right? He had the story, he had the why, he had the reason why segregation needed to stop. He didn't per se have the exact documents and the policies in place. You know, that came later on. That came from his brothers and sisters that were helping in the movement. But he stood up in front of the crowd. Remember outside what was Lincoln Memorial?
Yes.
And 250,000 people showed up. And of those 250,000 people, I think it was something like 30% were white people as well. And he commanded people to change their behaviors because there was this belief that we are all humans and we're all citizens of the world, that the segregation needs to stop. And hiding it doesn't mean that it's not there anymore. Hiding it just means you're being dishonest and racist.
Right.
And I think if we can take one piece of advice from Dr. Martin Luther King is with more compassion for our brothers and sisters, no matter what color their skin is, with being able to truthfully look other people in their eyes and understand that we have all got the same opportunities. And we really need to treat each other as we treat ourselves. And I really hope that day comes where this veil that you talk about, that, hey, like, I think it's in every country. There's a little veil everywhere. It's a little. Mm-hmm. America is slightly worse because
I think we're a little bit worse because of our quote-unquote values. This nation was stood up specifically on these principles, mm-hmm. life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, all men are created equal. Like, they put all those words into their founding document. I don't know if there's any other country on earth who's done that. So to me, that's what makes it worse here, is because we're humans just like every other group of people around this this world. And humans tend to try to amass power and then control and keep that power among people who are like them. It's just what human beings do. But when you have human beings in a place where they've said, we're not going to do any of that, and then they're still human, so they do all of that, it becomes so much worse because they're so invested in keeping their narrative plausible that they do even more to try to cover up and try to excuse and try to make it where it's their fault that they're being oppressed. Yeah. If they weren't like they were, we wouldn't treat them this way because our document says we shouldn't. And we are like our document. We're not like every other human being. No, you are. You've just kind of hamstringed yourself with a piece of paper that says we're going to treat everybody equally. And then when you don't do it, you have to make excuses for why not. And you blame the oppressed for their oppression. And that's really, to me, what makes it so different here, is because this is the only place that I know of where it's literally in the paperwork that it's not supposed to be this way. And yet it's no different from anywhere else. So there's got to be a reason. It's their fault. They do it to themselves.
Yeah, of course. It's the easy way out, right? Gerald, how are you currently serving the Black community?
So there are a couple things I'm doing. I've got my podcast, which is called By Black, The Voice of Black Business. And that is very specifically focused on helping Black business owners who aren't huge, who nobody would hear from or know if they didn't have a platform they could get onto for free. I find those people, actually now they find me, and they come onto my show and we have a conversation like this. We get their stories, their experiences, their knowledge out to the world. And the more of those stories that are being told, the more people are seeing, I have something to learn from Black business owners, both in and out of the Black community. I'm seeing that. The other thing is that shows a lot of other Black people who think, I want to be an entrepreneur, but I can't. And they hear people who are next door. They're not hearing your Oprahs or your Jay-Z's. They're hearing the person who literally is next door and their story of success. And it's giving them the confidence to say, I can go do this. I've gotten a lot of people who reached out to me and said, I started a business because I use this idea you talked about and I'm successful. So that's my main way that I'm helping the Black community right now. And then also in my coaching, I've developed a planning process that I call DOPE, the DOPE business planning process. And that I use to help small business owners to really get the right structure around their business so that it can be successful and it can grow. Because again, a lot of folks in the Black community who want to start a business, they start a passion business. They start a business based on their expertise and skill. They may not have a business degree. They may not have a business background. And so they end up almost just creating a self-employment job for themselves as opposed to a business that can run whether they're there or not. Yeah. And so I help them structure their business so that they can build a team and they can actually lead their business as opposed to just being the person doing all the work.
Yeah, of course. Guys, you can find that at dopebusinessplan.com. Gerald, what are the main obstacles that you're finding working with these small business owners? What are the main obstacles you're finding that they have? And what, if you can give us one or two tips or tricks that people could start using from today already?
Yeah, absolutely. So the biggest obstacle that every small business owner that I've talked to comes across is the fact that they do not take the time to lay out their mission and a vision and a set of core values that drives their company. Because every problem that I've helped people solve has always come back to that. Why does your business exist? What change do you want to make in the world? And what are the values that you that constrain you to say this is how we will or won't do business? That's the biggest problem. And it's also the biggest tip that I have. And I can talk a little bit about why those things are so important. If you actually take the time to write down a one sentence mission, this is why I exist. This is why I'm in the world. This is what I'm going to do. And you make that real and it goes straight to the heart of who you are. Every decision that you make from that point forward becomes a little bit easier because the question becomes, does this take me closer or farther from that? Right. Mm-hmm. And then when the answer is yes, it takes me closer. Sweet. I should probably do this. No, it takes me farther away from it. I probably should not. That's problem number one. The second problem, vision. Where do we want to be? What impact do we want to have on the world? Also goes back to every decision that you make. Is this going to help me make that impact happen or is it not? Yes or no? And it really, those things are about decision-making because business owners make 1,000 decisions a day. And then they hire people and they have a team and they start making 1,000,000 decisions a day because everybody's coming to them with their problems because obviously we don't hire people who solve problems for themselves, which is what we want from our teams. But anyway, so when you have that vision and people are coming and you're constantly having to make decisions, the dichotomy of does it take me closer or farther makes it easier to make that better decision. And the final component of that is your core values. And I don't mean like those hypocritical adjectives. Our core values are honor, integrity, courage. Yeah. No, I'm not talking about that. Core values being the things that you do, the behaviors that are your best self. You know, I personally have one core value, one. And that core value is love people and lead from your heart. That is it. If you have a set of core values for yourself or for your business, those are there to tell you what your left and right lateral limits are. What will I do and what won't I do in order to accomplish my vision and my mission? Because it's one thing to say I'm going to impact the world. It's another thing to say I'm going to impact the world by any means necessary. Yeah. And that by any means necessary puts you in a space where you could do a lot of really crap stuff on the road who impacting the world saying, well, the ends justify the means. The ends don't justify the means. Mm-hmm. Your core values tell you what means you will or will not use in order to accomplish your vision and mission. It keeps you ethically straight running your business. To me, those three things, I don't care whether you've got a huge corporation or whether you are a one-person shop. If you don't have those in place, every other decision you make is going to be infinitely more hard.
Yeah, powerful. You've heard it straight from Gerald Jones, guys. That is unbelievable. Gerald, I hope that everyone that listened to this takes that to heart and really sits down, whether it's morning, afternoon, night, whatever time you listen to this. I really urge everyone out there, sit down with a pen and paper, put that pen to that paper and write down your why, your vision, your mission statement of life. And the end never justifies the means. So a couple of bigger questions that I want to start ending off this podcast with. If you only had 24 hours to live, what would you be doing?
Would be hanging out with my wife and my kids in the woods in the mountains somewhere.
Amazing. Daily routines?
If I had 24 hours to live?
No, like your daily routines right now.
You know, I don't have a routine. I don't like routines. I know I wake up and then whatever happens in that day happens.
I can dig it.
Yeah. I've got a Google Calendar that tells me what all I have to do. When I wake up in the morning, I get a message at 5 o'clock in the morning, my email that says, this is what's on your calendar. So I'm at those places doing those things at those times. Other than that, literally whatever happens, happens.
Amazing. What do you think the soul is?
I think it is our connection to the universe. I think we are all a part of a universe that is driven by energy waves, and we can connect to it if we pay attention.
What's your definition of God?
The universe, myself. God is everything.
Complete the sentence. The world needs
more love.
Man, I love that. What is the purpose of the human experience?
To figure out, to become conscious of that connection we have with the rest of the universe, and then use our talents and our gifts to make a positive impact on that universe for the time we're here.
Gerald, everything that has come out of your mouth and your whole body, like, podcasters can't see you right now, but like seeing you, it's gravitates from a purpose of love, consciousness, and gratitude. And I can really see that. It's a very wise gesture coming out of you, and you're very composed, and it's been so beautiful to connect with you, even though it's not in person. But what you have been able to share with the audience today is unparalleled. So thank you so much.
I appreciate that. I appreciate you having me on, and I really appreciate the questions that you asked. You made me do a lot of self-reflection, which, again, as an introvert, I love doing that. I love thinking back and figuring out, are you doing the right thing? Did you do the right thing? What can you do next? So this has been a really great experience. And I love especially just connecting with you and the fact that you are from South Africa. So you have this very similar and yet different experience when it comes to race. And I don't know, I love perspective.
Yeah.
I love gaining more perspective. And so this has just been awesome.
Well, you need to come visit sometime, man.
I would love to get there. All right. More coaching clients. We'll
make it happen. Nice. So just to close off, where can people find you? What's the best way people can contact you?
Yes, absolutely. So best ways to contact me, for any of the major social medias, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, I am the same handle. It is at GWJONESII. It's Gerald W. Jones II. My email is Gerald, GERALD, at buyblackpodcast.com. And you can find my two websites. The one for the podcast is buyblackpodcast.com. And as Gary mentioned earlier, you can find my coaching planning strategy at dopebusinessplan.com.
There you got it, guys. And I will chat to you guys next week. I don't know about you guys, but I sure connected with this beautiful soul. Gerald Jones is not just your man next door. He is a voice to the black community once oppressed in America. He's a voice to a minority group that is so often forgotten about. And he is willing to stand up and speak for what is right, no matter if his comrade is black or white, Christian, Jewish, or Muslim. He's a man that believes that in order to progress, we need to overcome the segregation, and we need to look away from this apparent bias we have to, again, in inverted commas, our own people. Take a step out of your community into other communities. Start learning about other people, new people, what they believe in, what they treasure. And what you'll soon find out is we might separate ourselves from other people through vocabulary, but at the end of the day, happiness is what we strive for. We might have different methods, but let's take some time and learn all those different methods, and maybe, just maybe, we will attain a slight bigger understanding of this beautiful planet that we live in, with all the beautiful humans within. So guys, please make sure you follow Gerald Jones on his podcast, on his website. Email him if you have any questions. I know I have heaps of questions that I'm going to be asking him throughout life in general. Let's hope he doesn't change that email. And again, if you've got any questions for me, if you want to share some love, if you want to share some stories, please, I love that. You can reach me at garyterola.com. Otherwise, on Instagram, gary_terola. That's pretty much where I'm at. And guys, if you do want to go out and do a great deed today, please, I want to know more about it. Share it with me, tag me. I want to share your stories of a purpose-driven life because it inspires me. Have a beautiful week, and I'll chat to you next week.